This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 10th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Doreen Marina. Coming up on today's program, in Pakistan, a suicide bomber in a market has killed 30 as government forces continue the offensive in South Waziristan.
I heard a huge explosion and could not see anything. Then I saw flesh and bones and blood all around me. I did not know what was happening.
A top Senate Democrat releases a proposal to reform the nation's financial system.
It takes a moment like this. If there's any silver lining in this very dark cloud economically, it is that we're about to do something that we might not have been able to do but for the crisis we're in.
And we go to India, where the government is planning a military crackdown on Maoist rebels.
Some of the atrocities which they are committing against innocent women and children are unbelievable. And this is being justified in the name of economic and social justice.
Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Fort Hood, Texas this afternoon, standing behind a podium on a platform bearing 13 pairs of empty boots, President Obama memorialized each of the victims of last week's tragedy at the military base. He then turned to his justification for war.
For what he has done, we know that the killer will be met with justice in this world and the next. These are trying times for our country. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, the same extremists who killed nearly 3,000 Americans continue to endanger America, our allies, and innocent Afghans and Pakistanis. In Iraq, we're working to bring a war to a successful end, as there are still those who would deny the Iraqi people the future that Americans and Iraqis have sacrificed so much for. As we face these challenges, the stories of those at Fort Hood reaffirm the core values that we are fighting for and the strength that we must draw upon.
Hundreds of detainees in an Afghan jail in the southern province of Kandahar are on the third day of a hunger strike. Mujahid Jawad has more.
Around 350 political detainees say they are not provided with enough food and health services and are not allowed to talk to the visitors easily. They warn authorities that if their problems are not addressed, they will not quit their strike. They want the Afghan government to send them a mixed delegation of human rights groups, journalists, and members of the provincial council. Turialevi Saw, the governor of Kandahar province, said today that they're ready to send such delegation, but two other delegations, one from the Ministry of Justice and the other from the governor's office, have already been sent.
We also sent them a delegation yesterday, but the detainees weren't ready for talks. We hope that we can talk to them tomorrow, and we hope to hear their demands. They still haven't said anything about their demands.
Detainees say that some of them are suffering serious health effects due to their prolonged hunger. 18 months ago, prisoners in Kandahar staged another hunger strike. Many sewed their lips close in protest. Many prisoners escaped when the same prison came under attack just a few days later. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Mujahid Jawad, Fisarain, Kabul.
According to the Palestinian Man news agency, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas intends to resign his posts as leader of the Fatah Party and chair of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Just last week, Abbas announced he will not run in the 2010 elections. Free Speech Radio News' Rami El-Maghari is in Gaza.
Palestinian factions in the West Bank in Gaza have called on Abbas to reconsider. His plans to step down come as the Palestinian-Israeli peace process remains stalled, with U.S.-led efforts having failed to bridge the gap between the two sides. In Gaza, the rival Hamas party says the announcement is merely a, quote, hot ball thrown into its court, signaling what they consider is a failure of the Abbas-led PA to achieve peace with Israel. Hamas also calls on the PA to support the agenda of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Fatah and Hamas still have not reached a unity deal. Rami El-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News. Gaza.
Attacks against a union organizer spawned a subway strike in Argentina's capital today. Free Speech Radio News' Marie Trigona is in Buenos Aires.
Subway workers in Buenos Aires paralyzed subway lines, affecting more than 1.5 million passengers. Workers staged a strike earlier this month, demanding that the Labor Ministry grant legal recognition of a democratically voted independent union breaking from the UTA Transportation Union. Today's strike action was announced following attacks against a subway worker's family last week. The ex-wife and children of Nestor Segovia, an elected union representative, were attacked by police and affiliates of the UTA Transportation Union in their home during an alleged eviction notice. Nestor Segovia this morning.
The Metrovia subway carrier, along with the Labor Ministry, have fabricated lies about the subway delegates, that we are criminals. Mr. Labor Minister, you can resolve this conflict in 5 minutes. Sign our legal inscription as a union. The subway delegates have never betrayed workers, and we have always followed labor laws in the interest of the workers.
The strike may extend into the week. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
This evening, barring last-minute clemency, officials in Virginia are set to put John Allen Muhammad, also known as the D.C. Sniper, to death. Also tonight, officials in Texas will execute Yosvani Svaye. Yet in Texas today, the newly appointed chair of a commission to oversee forensic investigations faced tough questions from state senators about a stalled inquiry into a controversial execution. Renee Feltz reports.
The Texas Forensic Science Commission was in the middle of examining whether junk science by arson investigators led to the wrongful execution in 2004 of Todd Willingham when Governor Rick Perry replaced the commission's chairman. The new chairman, John Bradley, has focused on establishing rules for the commission. Critics say he's stalling on the Willingham investigation. Today, senators asked when he would continue reviewing the case. Bradley.
The commission is not charged with deciding whether people are guilty or innocent. The work of the Commission on Forensic Science will take as long as it deliberately takes.
Another Texas death row prisoner was set to die in 2004 for setting a house fire that killed two people, but Ernest Willis was released after prosecutors conceded there was no evidence of arson. Renee Feltz, Free Speech Radio News, Texas.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The top Democrat on the Banking Committee unveiled a major proposal to regulate the financial system. Senator Chris Dodd said inaction is unacceptable as the U.S. comes off the worst financial crisis in decades. Consumer advocates are praising the proposal as a victory. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
In a long-awaited announcement, Senator Chris Dodd, chair of the Banking Committee, released his plan to regulate the financial industry. The draft discussion is more than 1,000 pages. Both consumer advocates and the financial industry, who are often on opposite sides of reform, have called it comprehensive and would bring major changes to how the financial industry works. Senator Dodd said the financial crisis has motivated Congress to act.
It takes a moment like this. If there's any silver lining in this very dark cloud economically, it is that we're about to do something that we might not have been able to do but for the crisis we're in.
Like a companion bill in the House of Representatives, the legislation sets up a new regulatory agency for consumers. Currently, several financial agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission and the FDIC have dual roles, to oversee the banking system and to oversee consumer protection. Critics say consumer protection is often overlooked. This newly proposed Consumer Federal Protection Agency would oversee debit and credit card purchases, as well as car, home, and payday loans. Basically, any transaction that a consumer makes. But the financial industry is opposed to this new regulatory body. Jill Hershey is vice president of the Financial Services Roundtable.
We do think that it will be cumbersome in that you're creating a brand new federal agency at a time when I think resources can be deployed more efficiently and more effectively by keeping consumer protection, the function of consumer protection with banking regulators who are also looking out and examining for the safety and soundness of a financial institution. Safety and soundness and consumer protection go hand in hand.
But consumer advocates have long pushed for a separate body to watch out for consumers. Senator Dodd's bill is different than the version in the House of Representatives in one major way. It takes away a great deal of authority from the Federal Reserve. Senator Dodd said the Federal Reserve was, quote, a miserable failure in detecting the current economic crisis. So he proposes the creation of another regulator outside the Federal Reserve that would monitor systemic risk. In other words, it's an attempt to prevent what's become to be known as too big to fail. Ed Mierzwinski is with the public interest group U.S. PIRG. He agrees that the Federal Reserve failed to detect the current crisis, so he's praising the proposal.
In order to keep taxpayers, investors, and consumers safe, Dodd is saying, let's take some power away from the Fed. Let's create a new regulator. Let's make sure that as institutions get bigger and more systemically risky, that they pay more for that quote-unquote privilege.
Senator Dodd said fees placed on big banks will be incentive to not grow so large. Senator Dodd does not yet have the support of any Republicans, but the proposal is in the beginning stages of the legislative process. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C., the U.S. Senate has confirmed a new director for the federal agency charged with protecting communities from the impacts of coal mining. Joseph Pizarcik will head the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. He was confirmed by a Senate vote last Friday. But environmental groups have raised concerns throughout the nomination process. They say his track record in Pennsylvania at the state's Environmental Protection Agency shows a pattern of siding with industry over the needs of local communities in mining areas. We're joined by Chiara Curry. She's a biologist at the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental advocacy group based out of Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me on.
First, let's start with the position. Pizarcik will now head the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. It's a federal agency within the Department of Interior. What is this office responsible for?
He will be responsible for overseeing all surface mining across the entire nation and for enforcing the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, which is a law that was passed in the late 1970s. It was intended to minimize the effects of surface coal mining and other forms of mining on the environment.
Now, Joseph Pizarcik comes from Pennsylvania, where he was the director of the Bureau of Mining and Reclamation. What does his record say about his position on mining and environmental issues?
His record on environmental issues is absolutely atrocious, and that's why environmental organizations are so concerned that he is going to be in charge of all surface mining across the nation now. We opposed his nomination because of his record on the improper disposal of coal ash, because he weakened stream buffer zone rules, which means that under his supervision, he allowed coal mining companies to dump waste directly into streams. He advocated to try to weaken pollution control laws to allow more heavy metals and pollutants to be dumped directly into streams.
Is there a specific case or a specific example in Pennsylvania that illustrates Pizarcik's position on these issues?
There is. Concerning the disposal of toxic coal ash, his own agency, the Department of Environmental Protection, undertook this study of whether or not coal ash was contaminating drinking water supplies and groundwater. And what they found was that at 10 out of 15 of the sites where they had dumped this coal ash into unlined pits and into abandoned mines, it was indeed contaminating groundwater and drinking water with heavy metals. But Pizarcik consistently and on the record said that the disposal of coal ash in abandoned mines and unlined pits was not polluting the environment, even though his own agency did these scientific studies clearly showing that it is.
Environmental groups have been especially concerned about mountaintop removal. Describe what mountaintop removal is, and what is Pizarcik's position on the practice?
Mountaintop removal is a radical form of coal mining, in which they literally blow up the top of a mountain, which it happens in Appalachia. The mountains are about 3,000 feet tall, and by the top of a mountain, I mean the top 1,000 feet. So they can blow up the third of a mountain using explosives, and then they dump it directly into the streams below. So it completely destroys all of the wildlife, all of the forest, and all of the streams. And Vizarchuk doesn't have any background on it. He dodged questions about it during the confirmation process. And it's a hugely controversial issue right now. So we were hoping to get someone in that position who would try to rein in the environmental damage being caused by mountaintop removal.
Ken Salazar, the Secretary of the Department of Interior, praised the Senate's confirmation last week. I want to read a statement from Salazar from July of this year after President Obama nominated Pisarczyk for the job. Salazar said, quote, "Joe Pisarczyk brings a lifetime of experience and dedicated public service to ensuring mines are operated safely and in an environmentally sound manner. His expertise and record of innovation will ensure the coal production that is so necessary to meet our nation's energy needs is conducted in a way that respects the land and protects the environment." Your reaction?
My reaction is that he absolutely did not do his homework. If he had gone to Pennsylvania and talked to the people living in the communities that are affected by coal mining, then he could not confidently make that statement, because Joseph Pisarczyk's record on coal mining and coal ash disposal consistently favors industry and consistently weakens environmental laws.
We've been speaking with Tierra Curry, a biologist at the Center for Biological Diversity, about the recent confirmation of Joseph Pisarczyk to head the Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
In Pakistan today, a suicide car bomber struck a crowded shopping area, killing an estimated 30 people, including 7 children and 3 women. The attack took place in the northwest town of Charsada, about 20 miles outside of Peshawar. About 100 were injured, according to government officials. The street was home to many fruit and juice shops, but the blast tore apart market stalls and blew up vendors' push carts. Rashid John Khan is a shopkeeper in Charsada. He spoke to FSRN and was clearly still in shock after witnessing the attack. Today's attack killed his cousin.
I was in my shop and saw a Suzuki coming slowly towards people. The next minute, I heard a huge explosion and could not see anything because there was dust and smoke all around. Then, I saw flesh and bones and blood all around me. I did not know what was happening. My mind stopped working, and it is still not working properly because I do not know where I am.
Police said all who died were civilians. Today's attack follows 2 others. 3 died yesterday in Peshawar after a suicide bomber in a rickshaw detonated his weapon. On Sunday, a suicide bomber in a market on the outskirts of Peshawar killed 12, including a mayor who had spoken out against the Taliban. And last month, militants also targeted a crowded civilian area, killing more than 100 people in a suicide car blast at a Peshawar market. Government officials warn the attacks will likely continue. Mian Iftikhar is an information minister for Northwest Frontier Province.
These suicide attacks are in retaliation for the Waziristan operation. We expect more similar attacks in the future too, because it is a guerrilla war with an enemy who has been raised in our own society. It would be easy to fight with neighboring countries, but it's difficult to fight with people living in our own society. But I believe that the enemy is now weak. Therefore, they attack civilians because they cannot reach their main targets.
The Pakistani military started a new offensive mid-October in South Waziristan against militants known as Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. Their attacks have steadily increased since August after the United States killed their leader, Batula Masood, in a drone attack. In Nepal, thousands of former Maoist rebels have blocked roads going into Kathmandu, the capital. They are protesting a governing coalition and say they want a debate on presidential powers in the parliament. The government has refused the demand. Last year, Maoists won the majority in Nepal's first democratic election, but the coalition collapsed in May. Meanwhile, India's government is preparing a massive military operation against Maoist rebels across the country. The government calls the rebels, also known as Naxalites, the largest internal threat to the country. But the Maoists claim to be fighting for the rights of India's tribal people and rural poor. The planned crackdown has drawn criticism. Many say the military action does not address the root causes of the Maoist violence and will only complicate the problem. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani has the story.
It's about the poor. It's about their hunger. This is how revolutionary writer and poet Gadar defines India's Maoist movement. He says, India's march towards prosperity has left behind a trail of deprivation and despair, which the Maoists are struggling to mend.
They are revolutionaries. They live in the forests with the poor and the tribal people to protect them from the oppressors and to fight for their basic rights of food, shelter, and clothing. These are the people who have been deprived of everything in the name of development. We ask one simple question. Why is it that in this fast developing country, food has become so scarce for so many people?
The Maoist or the Naxalite movement in India was born as a result of a split in India's Communist Party in the late 1960s. Beginning as an uprising against landlords in West Bengal, the movement soon took the shape of an armed struggle, attracting supporters from landless rural poor, tribal people, students, and intellectuals alike. Today, its influence has expanded to large swathes in central and eastern India, with its popularity continuously growing. But security experts insist that it's no longer the same pro-poor movement it started off as four decades ago. Internal security analyst Ved Marwa says terrorists have hijacked the movement and they are now oppressing the same people they claim to be fighting for.
Now it's a different stage altogether. Now it's a struggle for power, political power, and in that phase they are committing atrocities which puts even what is happening in Jammu and Kashmir and North East in the background. I mean, in Chhattisgarh and in Jharkhand and Orissa, what they call the so-called liberated zones, some of the atrocities which they are committing against innocent women and children are unbelievable. And this is being justified in the name of economic and social justice.
The Naxals have dramatically increased their militant activities in recent months. In terms of casualties, they have surpassed even the separatist insurgencies in Kashmir and the northeastern regions. Nearly 5,000 people have been killed in Naxal attacks in the last 5 years, more than 600 of them since last January. The government has already declared them terrorists and is now planning a countrywide military operation to deal with what it describes as the biggest internal threat for the country. P. Chidambaram is India's Home Minister.
The left-wing extremists have extended their areas of influence. They've entrenched themselves. Today, they pose a very grave challenge to the state. And we are preparing to take on the challenge. Details cannot be disclosed. I have personally visited each state, and I'm in close touch with the chief ministers.
Most of the political parties are supporting the government's plan to take on the Maoists. Even the Marxist Communist Party, which had vehemently opposed the government's decision to ban the Maoists as a terrorist group a few months ago, also does not see any sense in resisting the move. Prasenjit Bose is a senior member of the party.
Their approach towards democracy is highly problematic. If they are fighting against capitalist exploitation, if they are fighting against imperialism, if they are fighting against, you know, more rights for the Adivasis, why can't they fight within the democratic framework just like the Maoists in Nepal, just like us, our party in India, just like other CPIML factions in India? You know, you are talking about the state-sponsored violence. How can they justify the fact that they are attacking cadres of political parties?
Murdabad! 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 Inqilab! Zindabad! Zindabad!
But the proposed military crackdown is evoking protests from various civil rights groups, students' movements, and intellectuals who view the Maoists as a legitimate people's movement against state repression. Dr. Aparna, member of the Federation of Indian Trade Unions, is among the protesters in New Delhi.
In the name of attacking Naxalite movement, the government of India has actually launched a war against the people of the country with a specific aim to sell the rich resources of this country ad lib to foreign companies for profit and for loot. Today the debate is actually on the control of these resources, which the government wants to sideline in the name of a debate on peace and violence. There is not going to be peace so long as there is loot. And that will be, even if you annihilate the last Naxalite, it will still be so.
Analysts warn that the military action will have serious social and political consequences, but preparations for the offensive are in full swing, and a bloody confrontation appears to be inevitable. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Carnage at Fort Hood, Texas. Once again, an American soldier has gone on a rampage, shooting other American soldiers. What makes this news even more remarkable than usual is the fact that the shooter is more than a soldier. He's a doctor and a psychiatrist. Oh, and he's Muslim. Major Dr. Nidal Malik Hassan reportedly opened fire against fellow soldiers, wounding several dozen and killing at least 13 at last count. Which feature of this deeply divided psyche moves such a man to storm his own base and blast his own comrades at Fort Hood, Texas? Doctor? Hardly. Psychiatrist? Doubtful. Major? Unlikely. Muslim? The answers to these questions may take some time. Major Dr. Hassan, shot by responding security, is reportedly in a coma and thus unable to provide any information. But given what we know of the transcendent power of religious belief, we can't say such elements are unimportant. Early reports, which are notoriously unreliable, note Major Dr. Hassan had expressed an unwillingness to ship out to his next posting in Afghanistan, an ancient Muslim community with growing nationalist resistance to U.S. and Western occupation. Major Dr. Hassan, born in America, was an American citizen, born, educated, and raised. In his professional capacity as an Army psychiatrist, he undoubtedly heard the deepest fears, hatreds, and perhaps racist revulsions against Arabs and Muslims expressed by his Army comrades. What kind of stresses and conflicts could this have sparked in the man's mind? This act may prove to be the ultimate act against the wars in and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, not by a terrorist madman, nor by an anti-war leftist, but by an American soldier, an officer, and presumably a gentleman, a doctor, and a psychiatrist. Perhaps this was his verdict on the war. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.